All right, and we should be live. I'm Adam Taggart, founder of Wealthion, welcoming you to another monthly live Q&A with Wealthion's endorsed financial advisors. And we've got a murderer's row here, folks, a true rogues gallery of greats. We've got our U.S. Endorsed advisors, but this is also the first one we're doing with our new Canadian endorsed advisor. So let me quickly dial around the table here. We've got Michael Leibowitz from Real Investment Advice. He is here instead of Lance Roberts, and thank goodness we got rid of that Lance guy. And we've got Michael joining us today. Michael, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Great. And staying in the top row here, we've got Jonathan Wellum, who is the founder or lead partner at RockLink Financial, and he is our new Canadian advisor. Jonathan, welcome.
Thank you very much, Adam. Glad to be part of the group.
It's a real pleasure. And then, as always, below, we've got John Lodra and Mike Preston coming from New Harbor Financial, our other U.S.-based financial advisor. So, folks, we've got an embarrassment of riches here today. We'll go the full hour, already having a lot of questions come through, both on Twitter and starting to here in the live chat as well. And, folks, so the way this works is if you're watching live right now as we're recording this, ask your questions in the live chat. I will do my best to surface as many of those as I can during the hour for our speakers here. If you're watching on replay, just lean back and enjoy. All right, guys. Well, look, lots to talk about, even some late breaking news here. why don't we start with the debt ceiling? That seemed to be a lot of questions around that. We had a lot of drama that continued over the weekend, continuing through today. I think there's a talk later on today, scheduled between President Biden and Speaker McCarthy. The big question that continues to be asked here is what would happen to the markets, particularly to bonds, if we go into this X date without an agreement? You know, I think on the extreme end, some people are worrying that if they're holding instruments like U.S. Treasuries, that they might not get paid. I have addressed this many times. I think the odds of that are extremely low, but I would like for you all to be able to give people whatever, you know, counsel assurances you think are merited given the situation right now. Michael Leibowitz, why don't we start with you?
So I think what's important to realize is as we get closer to the X date, the Treasury is going to shut down payments for not for bonds, but for other things that are not necessary. So for instance, the national parks will not get funded. And as they start stopping those payments, it's going to have a big effect on those senators, those representatives from those districts. You know, think about the state of Wyoming. When they go to shut down Yellowstone during the heart, you know, clearly getting very close to the heart of travel season, they're taking a big economic hit to Wyoming. So I think what we're going to find is as we get closer, as some of these payments stop, that there's more reason for agreement. And look, we've done this, I forgot the number, 60, 70 times since 1960. Sometimes they're rough, like 2011. Other times they're not. There's a lot of political dissension, but they will come to an agreement. They're certainly not going to default. Do they miss a payment by a day? Possibly. And if you own a very short-term treasury bill, that can have a decent effect. But look, this is just like we've seen, it's political theater, and they do this to some degree every time. And I don't see any reason why this time is different.
All right. And Michael, before I move on to the other speakers here, I'm just curious what impact you think this may have on the markets or the bond markets, you know, if the drama continues from here.
So the bond market has been slowly leaking, i.e. going up slightly in yield, but it's not panicking. We're seeing more activity like in the 1 month bill, which is now about 5.5%. It should be closer to 5%. But again, it's a 1 month security. Stock market has shown next to no concern. But, you know, if you look at the markets, they're not concerned. If you look at the headlines, there's fear being shouted. The politicians are being very loud and also selling fear. but the markets aren't buying it right now. Now, I guess if things get bad and they don't come to agreement and it lingers, those markets have a lot of adjustment to do. Bond yields will go higher, stock prices will go lower, the dollar will probably falter, and gold will probably do very well until there's a resolution.
Okay. And, you know, you guys don't have to share this. I've sort of suggested that that's often the party that's out of power strategy all along, is to kind of play a game of chicken with the party that's, you know, sitting in the White House to try to create some market dyspepsia, which it can then use to force a concession. So we'll see how far we go down that path this time around. New Harbor guys, Mike, John, I'll let whichever one of you wants to jump in on this. Anything else you want to add on this particular topic?
Yeah, I'll just chime in. Totally agree with Michael Leibowitz here. This is political theater of the grandest sorts. Can't be overstated how central to the financial system plumbing the Treasury market is. You're thinking about things like collateral in margin accounts and all kinds of financial transactions. The ramifications, I think, would be quite dramatic if there were a true devolving of this situation into a kind of a default of sorts. I did want to just touch upon Michael's comment about many times this has been a nothing burger, but you did rightly point out that 2011, there were some fireworks in asset markets. And I'm just looking at a chart that B of A put out. You know, they did a quick chart showing the max drawdown or draw up around the July, August 2011 fireworks on the debt ceilings, and the S&P 500 dropped, you know, max drawdown was about 17% drawdown, whereas things like gold and long-term treasuries and VIX spiked, you know. So for example, gold was up about almost 28% max spike in the vicinity of that drama. TLT, the proxy for long-term treasuries, that was up almost 19%, and VIX spiked 32%. Temporary moves, I wouldn't read anything into those other than just to say that there can be fireworks in the short term, as 2011 exhibited.
Yeah, we have a lot of precious metals holders that watch this channel, and given some of the questions that have been asked, some of them are here today in the live chat. They probably wouldn't mind a little drama that would create a 28% jump in gold. You did mention TLT, and maybe Jonathan, I'll come to you to let you add anything else you might want to add to this, but people are sort of asking, hey, is this not a bad time to get into TLT here in the short term? Jonathan, if you have any opinion on that too, feel free to chime in.
Sure. I'll be the Canadian talking about the U.S. U.S. situation. I think that this time, I agree with what's been said by the two gentlemen already, that this is it is political theater and it will get solved. The issue is how many sparks will there be? I think that, again, my observation is that I think there will be more political sparks this time. I think it will be more of a 2011 situation. And I say that only because of the extremity of the deficit. We've seen this in Canada also. Governments are just running massive deficits. And I think that McCarthy is under tremendous pressure by his conservative constituents not to give in too early. So I think that it clearly will be solved. The U.S. is not going to default. But the issue for us as we're looking at investments is how much tightening will there be? Will Biden be given free rein or not? And how tight it will McCarthy be able to negotiate this? That, I think, will impact more of the investments over time. I think that's what the market is really looking at. We know it's going to get solved, but is the U.S. going to continue to run these multiple trillion-dollar deficits? Are you going to continue to add 5-6% debt to GDP deficits to GDP? That is clearly unsustainable. And from our perspective, we're watching really the resolution on what side does it go, left or right, and that will certainly impact some of our investments in terms of whether we have more exposure in precious metals and some of the areas that are going to be more resilient to dollar volatility. So that's what we're focusing on. But this idea that they're going to default, I mean, that's not going to be the case. It'll be, in our view, just how tight the budget will end up being, and can they rein in this runaway deficit, which is completely and totally out of control and unsustainable.
Yeah, great points. And I understand that none of you are, you know, political analysts. So a lot of the political side, we're just sort of, you know, guessing on. And from what I've read, you know, it sounds like the Republicans are really you know, trying to push for spending cuts. The Democrats are trying to not have to get boxed into spending cuts. They're trying to talk about spending freezes or tax freezes or whatnot. And there's a pretty big gap between the two. So we'll see how this gets resolved. The one thing I thought was interesting is, and understandable, is the administration is pushing for the debt ceiling to be raised, the next raise to be pushed off post 2024 elections, right? And the Republicans are fighting to have it basically be a year from now. And of course, if you're the party out of power, you want this to be a thorn in the side of the administration going into the election. Of course, the administration doesn't want to have to deal with it. So I think that's going to be a really big negotiating point too. All right. You talked about how tight things are going to get, and I want to get to central bank monetary policy in just a second. Real quick, though, I do want to take a detour just based on something that happened literally sort of minutes before we all got online here today, which was there was a quick jolt to markets that was extremely short-lived. I don't know if you guys saw this, but there was a report going out of an explosion near the Pentagon. And then very quickly, it was determined that this was an AI-generated photo and that it was, you know, quote unquote, fake news, misinformation. And at least going into this this live session here with you guys, it seems like enough disavowals came out and said, yeah, no, this is fake. You know, people have been on site down there. There's nothing going on. I just want to show this tweet in response to this, which is faked AI images moving markets. Welcome to the future. So, you know, so much of the discussion recently has been about, you know, what the impact of AI is going to be. And we kind of have this, you know, AI driven rally going on in the market here. You know, here's sort of one other, you know, unintended consequence, knock on effect of AI, which is that it's going to be increasingly easy for the world to get fooled, at least temporarily, by people who are trying to manipulate markets with false information. I'm just curious, as a capital manager who has to, you know, process information and then act on it, like how concerned are you about how AI might be able to kind of, you know, stir the pot here and make your guys' jobs harder? Michael, I see you smirking some here. I don't know if you've got a strong opinion on this or not.
Not necessarily a strong opinion, but it's something we talk about a lot because it affects every aspect of our business, not just investing, but client relations. You can have AI replicate a client's voice and order us to do something. So it's basically everything we do is going to have to change. We're going to need to, both with our clients and with market moving events, prove that they are correct or incorrect before we take any sort of action. And I think that's the new world we're in, whether we like it or not. It's so easy to replicate a voice, replicate an image. And, you know, there was a parody around on Twitter a couple weeks ago of Chairman Powell speaking. And it was clearly a parody, but it could have just as easily, they could have taken it more serious, and it really could have moved the markets until it was disavowed. So, you know, I think all aspects of our life are going to change because of AI, some for the better, some for the worse. And it's just something we have to deal with going forward.
Boy, that is a scary future. I hadn't really been thinking about, you know, the person calling up, pretending to be the client and, you know, asking for account transfers out and all that type of stuff. Crazy. All right. Look, as I said to you speakers, if you have anything to add on to any question, feel free to raise your hand or whatnot. If not, I'm just going to kind of keep surfing through our topics here. So back to tightening. There was an announcement today by James Bullard of the Fed, who said that he sees the potential for two more rate hikes this year. And that still stands in very stark contrast to what markets are pricing in here. So I'm going to put up this chart that hopefully you all can see. The blue line here is sort of what Bullard is thinking about where the Fed funds rate's going to go. The red line is what the market is currently pricing in. And you'll see, you know, they're in pretty stark contrast, where Bullard has the Fed funds rate ending somewhere around 5.6% at the end of the year, where the market is down around 4.75. Now, this has been kind of the story of the year, where Fed has been talking a tough game and the markets have been saying, nah, I don't believe you. Now, the markets have been having to follow the Fed here a bit. You know, they keep having to change their expectation because the Fed has remained more resolute than the markets, you know, were expecting. In fact, the markets initially were pricing in a pivot for June, which, you know, just a couple weeks away at this point. Clearly, that doesn't seem like that's going to happen. I guess question for you guys is, you know, where do you see us headed forward from here? What do you see as more likely, the Fed actually delivering on its continued hawkishness and its continued resoluteness to, if not continue to hike more, at least hang out for the rest of the year at these prices, which is something that Jerome Powell has said very clearly is his plan. He said he doesn't see any rate cuts this year, versus the market, which just definitely doesn't seem to believe that. Jonathan, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, I mean, a couple of things. I mean, first of all, we are longer term investors. And so we are not trying to get too caught up in the day-to-day movements, whether it's AI or anything else. When we look at the market, we look at the economy, and I'm again looking at it from a Canadian perspective, where things are a little bit tougher up here. The economy is much slower growth. We've already started, our Bank of Canada already is holding rates. And there's a lot of pressure on them to put rates up, but that's only because the differential between the Canadian rate and the U.S. Fed's rate is becoming quite large, which puts pressure on our dollar. But I'm of the opinion that the rates already in the system will continue to constrain the system quite a bit, the economy, and we're starting to feel the pressure of that. Certainly in Canada, we're feeling the pressure. There's a massive indebtedness in the population. Mortgages are coming due. And so we're seeing that tension. So I think the Fed, I would not be surprised if the Fed increased another time. I can't see two rates, though. What are we doing in light of that? Because we don't know. We're being very careful. We're keeping a little bit more cash on the side. We are buying businesses that are very defensive and can grow regardless of what the Fed does in terms of its rates, are quite resilient in terms of the economy. So we're kind of hedging our bets because we're just, again, watching this thing on play out, and it's very difficult to know whether it's one or two, but that should not affect the businesses that we're buying longer term. It really affects just maybe carrying a little bit more cash around so we can take advantage of volatility if there's some surprises in the markets. That's really what we're doing.
All right. Makes sense. Mike Preston, I'm coming to you here, buddy. What would you add on to what Jonathan said?
Well, I think that we're in the camp of thinking that the Fed is going to remain steadfast and resolute. Not really sure if they're going to tighten, raise rates one or more times. That's all speculation. It really doesn't matter that much. We too are long-term investors. We're holding quite a bit of treasury bills and cash equivalents, more than 45% presently. You know, with treasury bills over 5%, really out to about 6 months, there's not really a lot of reason to take much risk. We have some key areas that we've been in for a while, namely mining shares, commodities, resource companies, that type of thing. But really, we want to be tactical in what we think is going to be an elevator drop in the market at some point. And I really don't think the Fed and Powell is going to pivot until we see that. He's been very consistent. He's talked about pain in the past in the market. I think that in a way he wants to see that pain in the market. It really has to be that way to give them the cover they need to, you know, to return and probably to quantitative easing at some point. So the market is more than fully valued, depending upon which way you measure it. And we could argue that here, I guess. But the Shiller price earnings ratio is above 30. The margin adjusted Shiller price earning ratio is above 40, and at levels that really have never been seen before. I suppose just a little bit of time at the end of 2021. So you know, the yield curve is solidly inverted. We truly think there's going to be a rush into the longer side of the curve at some point. I don't know if that'll be coincident with a change in Fed policy. I think it'll likely be coincident with a drop in the markets and a realization that all is not well. I think that it's really surprising that the S&P 500 is floating around, you know, pretty darn close to its record high with rates above 5% on the short end. Not too long ago, we were all saying, Well, there is no alternative. Rates are zero. That's why equity prices are so elevated at record levels. And here we are with T-bills above 5%, and we still float along like nothing's going on, which is shocking to me. And volatility is back, you know, down around 16 or 17. So just one more thing in closing. One of the viewers asked a question about TLT, and I just want to respond to that. I don't think we really responded to that yet. And while I've got to disclaim everything I say here is not specific investment advice, I'll try to talk in generalities. Longer term U.S. bonds have been, they sold off quite a bit about a year ago, not quite a year ago, fall of last year. I think what we saw, what was the capitulation moment in TLT? It was in the low 90s. This morning, it's just hovering just above 100. TLT yields in the threes here. It's very oversold. I do believe that there'll be a rush into longer term bonds at some point, probably when the yield curve begins to uninvert. And you could look at that, that investment or something similar to it, and even do a covered call on it if you wanted to do something very conservative. I just happen to be looking at the options chain, and you can sell call options against something like TLT in for 90 days. You get something like $3, 3% for 90 days. I mean, that annualizes out at close to 20% if you include the dividend, and you get some pretty good downside protection. So again, not specific advice for anyone in particular, just an example of some of the unique things you can do with instruments like that, particularly if you believe in the longer term prospect of them and want to enter a hedged entry.
All right. Well said, Mike. I was sort of smiling earlier when you said that, the rationale for stocks being highly priced was that there was no alternative, right? When yields were zero, now we're at 5% and markets are still surprisingly robust. I've had a lot of comments from folks about same thing about the housing market, right? You know, housing prices were super elevated because mortgage rates were so cheap. Now mortgage rates are, near 7%, at least here in the States. And people are complaining that prices really haven't come down that much in their areas. And Mike Leibowitz, I'm going to come to you with this. This is, are we sort of seeing sort of like a Wile E. Coyote moment here where prices just haven't felt the force of gravity yet, but that's sort of the inevitable next step here? Or are there reasons to, credible reasons to suggest that asset prices can remain supported at these levels? And I just want to put up a couple of visuals here real quickly. Here's a chart of commodity price changes over the past year. And you'll see there've been a couple of commodities that have appreciated more than the general CPI, but you'll see there's way more, that have come down by double digits, in some cases, really substantial double digits. And I remember showing similar stats from Charlie a year ago that were the inverse of this. Right, where you just had dramatic, oftentimes like triple digit increases in commodities like lumber and, a number of the ones we're seeing here that have now really come off a lot. So we're already beginning to see, really substantial price declines in key commodities. And I want to just supplement this with this tweet here from technical analyst Sven Trader, who brings up the lag effect, which we've talked a lot about on this program over many months now. That they typically take, he says 12 to 18 months. I've heard 9 to 12 months. There's debate on sort of what the average time filter is. But it does take, somewhere around a year for when the Fed pulls a policy lever to see the full impact of that in the economy. And he's reminding us that last time, a year ago now, the Fed funds rate was still below 1%. So we have all of these Fed funds past rate hikes that are now traveling through time. The shock waves are traveling through time and should be slamming into us for the next several quarters here. As Sven says, the hammer is still coming. So back to my question about sort of the Wile E. Coyote moment here. Are markets really kind of just living in the last days of denial before all this happens and gravity pulls the coyote back down to earth? Or are there valid reasons for prices to stay high?
So look, valuations are high to very high, in some cases absurd, especially in some of the AI space right now and a couple other areas. The macro picture does not look good. you know, the lag effect of those rate hikes will hit at some point and will be a drag on the economy. So you know, when you look at it fundamentally, macro wise, it's and valuation wise, it's very hard to be invested. But at the end of the day, stocks and bonds and everything else are driven purely by liquidity. And there's still a lot of liquidity out there. I know the Fed is taking away $95 billion of bonds a month, but they're adding liquidity via some of these other programs. The Treasury general account at the Fed has been falling, which adds liquidity to the market. Now, that will increase once they get past this debt cap. Once they increase the debt cap, that's going to increase and take away liquidity. And there's also perceived liquidity. So there's the perception that what the Fed is doing with the repo program, what they're doing with some of these other programs actually add liquidity, what they're doing with the regional banks adds liquidity. And we can argue all day whether they do or don't, but if investors think they do, then it's giving another reason to buy. And, you know, on top of that, there's a lot of technical indicators that are bullish right now. We're above all the key moving averages. You know, a lot of our longer term indicators are on bullish readings right now. So we're very torn, and we are too, sitting on a decent amount of cash. We're being prudent. We understand that there's a huge gap between what the Fed thinks they're going to do and what the market thinks they're going to do. So it's time to be prudent. It's time to really think things out, because markets can go a lot further than people think they can go. And we've seen enough instances of that. And that's both upside and downside. And the, you know, like we've all said, the economic picture is fine right now. In fact, the Atlanta Fed GDP thinks we're going to have 3% growth this quarter after a solid quarter last quarter. But again, it's the future, and how will those prior rate hikes really slap the market, and what effect will that be? How will the regional bank crisis affect lending standards, and how much will they pull back? Those are all big items, and in my mind, it comes down to employment. If the unemployment rate starts ticking up, we're getting much closer to a recession, but the unemployment rate is still right near 50-year lows. And yeah, there's been some uptick in jobless claims and some of the other employment indicators, but there's nothing recessionary about them yet. So for us, watching the employment indicators, and there's a whole slew of them, it's not just the monthly report that comes out from the BLS, is how we can gauge whether this economy is slipping into a recession. And that'll help us understand better what the Fed may or may not do and whether it equates to what the market is saying they're going to do.
Yeah, and on that last point on employment, you know, frequent viewers of this channel have heard us talk a lot about Michael Kantrowitz's HOPE framework, which the E in that HOPE framework is employment, and that is the last phase of how the economy falls into recession and climbs out of one. And you know, looking at Michael's scorecard right now, the H, the O, and the P in HOPE, those dominoes have all kind of falling or in the process of falling. The E has been the bulwark against recession. And all eyes are on it now to see, okay, how resolute is that going to be able to be? I think we are beginning to see some data, like you said there, Michael, that's suggesting it's beginning to weaken a little bit. When I was talking to Stephanie Pomboy on this channel, I brought up a chart that I'll try to find in a little bit of another way to look at employment, and this is withheld taxes by the Treasury, withheld payroll taxes. Mm-hmm. And this is a daily data set that the US Treasury publishes. If you look at that, it tells a very different story than the BLS numbers, a much less rosy one. And I'm not necessarily saying that's the only data point to look at, but to your point there, Michael, you gotta look at all the different data points around employment, and many of them that are non-governmental are telling a very different story. So it's going to be interesting to see, again, what sort of prevails in the long run here. I want to stick on this theme for a moment. John Lodera, I'm coming to you here. I know you've got similar, you know, outlook as Michael there, at least on valuations, that, you know, they're still very rich in this space. But I am curious, you know, this whole topic of the lag effect of you know, are we, have we really seen the impact yet of all of these Fed rate hikes, or are they still out there? And John, Michael, you mentioned liquidity. Maybe I'll saddle you with this question, John. This is a tough one, which is, if you look at charts of the central bank balance sheets and, you know, the S&P, it's very clear the correlation is super tight, right? And at some times we have remarked that maybe all we need to do is just look at liquidity, and that's really going to tell us where the markets are going. What is liquidity doing right now? You know, we've had a lot of signs of, you know, QT and bank lending standards tightening and all sorts of things that seem to be contractionary, certainly relative to where we were in, say, 2001, where we were still, you know, pumping stimulus into the system right and left, right? We've had the fiscal stimulus largely turn off. We've had monetary stimulus go into reverse. So you would think that we are in a liquidity draining cycle here. But, you know, as Michael said, we have the not QE that was started earlier this year, that whether it's true QE or not, if the market thinks it is, that may be all that matters. We had China start reopening back last October. We saw that's when the markets bottomed. I know Mike Leibowitz, RIA, has put out some charts that show liquidity, you know, measurements as that liquidity has been moving back up. So are we in a liquidity draining cycle here? Or are we actually in the liquidity adding cycle here? It's not super clear to me how to measure that. So anyways, John, I'm going to task you with that.
Yeah, well, thank. We're all in the business. I think I speak for the whole panel. We're in the business of getting hard questions. So keep them coming. I want to give Michael a nod. He did reference the idea that, you know, liquidity is a kind of a difficult thing to define. And I think conveniently, we've kind of gotten in a cycle of looking at central bank balance sheets and the expansion of those, which has kind of been more or less unidirectional over the last decade, and simplistically saying that's liquidity, and you know, overlaying a chart of the S&P 500 to those balance sheets and saying, see, that's all that matters. I think that's way too simplistic. And one of the features of liquidity, I think, is credit. And one of the key barometers or limiters, I should say, of credit is interest rate levels. We are dramatically higher now than we were a year and a half ago, a year ago, and for very much the last decade. And when you think about things like carry trades, leverage trades, the cost of money, the short-term interest rate is a key input to that. So dramatically, I think liquidity has you know, dramatically tightened. Lending standards, these are all kind of forms of liquidity that fuel the speculative engine that has driven this market for much of the past decade. So I think it's overly simplistic to think about Fed, central bank balance sheets and say that's it. I will point out that, you know, we talked, you put up a chart earlier about Bullard's, you know, own projection of where rates would likely be, you know, a couple more raises. I did see that Neil Kashkari was out saying, even if we paused at the June meeting, that doesn't mean future rate hikes are not very much on the table. I just want to say that I think, and my partner Mike mentioned this, we're not very much in the camp that the Fed is going to pivot anytime soon. We think there will have to be some dramatic carnage in financial markets and the economy for the Fed to kind of go and start to reverse direction of interest rate moves. And, you know, let's just go back to the last two major sell-offs, the housing bust and the tech bust. The Fed was dramatically lowering interest rates throughout those free falls, and it did nothing. So I would like to just footnote this idea that liquidity is all that matters. It's liquidity plus, I think, more overwhelmingly, the psychology and the fear and greed elements of investor psychology. When investors in mass get fearful and start hitting the exit, we know from history that, you know, just simply turning the liquidity spigot back on doesn't stem that. It can oftentimes go very much in the pendulum swing in the other direction, and you know, people just panic out regardless of what's going on there. So that's kind of my quick take on that.
Okay. Jonathan, I'll come to you to let you comment on this topic and just add to this. I don't know the situation in Canada, so forgive me. Here in the States, we have still the brunt of the lag effect of all those rate hikes coming our way. We have the increased tightening of lending standards that has been added post the banking system instability, which, you know, Powell has admitted that acts as additional rate hikes under the system. We have Bullard, believe him or not, saying that the Fed's still going to continue hiking from here, right? QT is going to continue tightening. We also have this TGA, the Treasury General Account, which is, as Michael Leibowitz said, has been getting drawn down, and that has been pushing liquidity into the system. As I understand it, once the debt ceiling, once an agreement is reached, the Treasury is going to have to start refilling that TGA account by selling a bunch of treasuries, right? And that is going to be pulling liquidity, you know, out of the market into these new bonds. So, you know, I guess my question is to my eye, it seems like I can make a lot of arguments for things really continuing to tightening as we head into the second half of this year. Do you see a similar kind of hoovering up of liquidity, or are there other factors going on we need to keep our eyes on?
Yeah, I mean, I largely agree with what the other panelists have said. In terms of the Canadian situation, let me add just one other item that concerns us, and that is, you know, with inflation, wages have not been keeping up with inflation, and so I think that the average consumer is feeling it from a financial perspective, and that's why we're seeing credit card balances go up and people using more credit if they can get access to it. So that's another factor that we watch and are concerned about. I think that also will lend itself to the central banks eventually having to back off. The other thing in Canada, our mortgages up here are typically, you know, 25-year amortizations. But they have to be reset. The maximum you can go in terms of term is generally around 5 years. And many people have the adjustable rate mortgages. And so we don't have these 30-year type of mortgages that they have in the States. And so there's a much shorter period of time. And so we are seeing the impact of these rates going up and the impact on mortgages and the pressure that's had on the real estate market. That is coming a bit faster and faster in Canada.
Let me just ask there. They pretty much, it's like a 5 year period when you take them out, right? So basically, every year you have 20% of your mortgages that are re-rating, correct?
That is exactly right, Adam. And what we, if you look at the banks, if you look at CIBC up here, it's a large bank, it's got some presence in the US, or TD Bank, which has a large presence in the United States. If you look at their notes to their financials, we've seen that the about 25 to even 30% of Canadian mortgages now are being amortized over 35 years. And so the rate increase is really pinching Canadians in a major way on mortgages. And what the banks are doing is just extending the amortization period. And so the pressure is on already up here. And I think that you will see more of that in the US as there is some repricing, and it does take time. In Canada, in the real estate market's a little bit faster because of the structure of our mortgages. And then the in terms of again, credit balances, we continue to see those going up, not down. And so I think there's this, to me, there's a tension between liquidity being pulled out and liquidity being added still. And it's a bit of a war going on. And so you can line up factors that are pulling liquidity out. You can also see some of these factors which are cranking it in. I think that just tells us that the economy is under a lot of pressure, and why investors need to be careful, buy high quality, keep some powder dry, and be defensive in the midst of this. Valuations are high. We've heard this across all the panelists. They're exactly right. And that's the way we're approaching it, because it's hard to know exactly how much liquidity is going in and out. And because we've got a net flow, we're trying to keep our eyes on, it's hard to know exactly what that net is. That's why we're being careful. And those are just a couple of points more from the Canadian perspective.
Okay. Yeah, man, I just try to think about what would happen here in the States if we had 20% of our mortgages re-rating right now. God, it would be just bedlam, I think. All right, Michael Leibowitz, I'm coming to you with a question. And Mike Preston, I'm going to come to you with some user questions about gold. Mike, I'm just going to put up Mike Leibowitz, I'm going to put up a chart here for you just to react to, which shows that S&P earnings actually grew by 8% in Q1. So, you know, you're beginning to hear stories now of like, well, maybe the worst is behind us now, right? Maybe, you know, we've made it through the tough times, earnings are going to start growing again. And that is, you know, an argument for the market's not correcting any further, and, you know, better times ahead. And as you've said, you know, we're seeing this sort of AI driven I won't call it euphoria just yet, but we're kind of getting close to that term in the AI stocks. Right. Yeah. So I guess my question is just, you know, have the bears been too bearish about the macro side of things? Like maybe not get the earnings recession this year that many were predicting. How do you react to this latest S&P earnings data?
So S&P actually is starting to increase earnings for the rest of this year and next year as well, which means they don't see a recession. And look, inflation, for the most part, not for every company, but for a lot of companies, has been good for margins. They've been able to pass on more in prices to their clients, to their customers, than they had to pay for them. They've also been able to cut costs. And AI, look, on the margin, it's not huge now, but it is reducing their costs and improving their margins. So far, earnings have been fine, right? But again, this comes down to what we've been talking about. Will there be a recession or not? And at the end of the day, and this doesn't affect necessarily trading for the next month, for the next 2 weeks, for the next 2 months, but at the end of the day, we are a 1.5 to 2% economic growth country. We are more saddled with debt today than we were in 2020 because of the pandemic. So if anything, our debt growth, economic growth rate going forward is going to be less than it was. And that has been trending lower for 30 years. Inflation has been roughly trending lower for 30 years too. So you can't have an environment where interest rates are 3, 4, 5% in an economic growth environment of 1.5% to 2%. It's a huge tax on the economy that will ultimately weigh and become enough of a headwind to both hurt the economy and hurt corporate earnings. The question again, though, is when will that take effect? And I think what we've all failed, and not just us, but just about everyone, and most importantly, the Fed, they have failed to consider the velocity of money. Velocity of money is upticking, meaning that more and more dollars get spent more quicker than they used to. Money is just circulating through the economy at a greater rate, and that's offsetting the decline in the money supply. And it, you know, the Fed controls the money supply. They have much less control over velocity. So the stimulus from 2021 and the change behaviors are having a much better, you know, bigger effect on the economy, and it's helping the economy for now. And the question is, when do we fully normalize? When do we get back to 1.5 to 2% growth? And when will interest rates and lending standards allow that to happen or make it happen? And, you know, when you answer those questions, that's where you get into earnings, because earnings are a function of the economy. And, you know, I feel like we're in no man's land. Trying to predict where earnings will be a year from now is really hard, because if we're in a recession, they're going to be lower. But if we kind of muddle along, but if we continue to grow at, you know, 3% for the next year, if this can continue for a year, then the forecast for growing earnings is probably a good forecast.
Okay. And I had this discussion with Lance over the weekend, and it's hard for me to wrap my brain around or to say this, but like, you know, what Lance was sort of saying is look, we've talked about this stimulus pig going through the python, and it just may have been a much bigger pig than folks realized. And that there just still may be enough of it in there that it is driving the economy in the way that you've said there, Michael. And we don't have great exact measurements of it.
No, and I think what's equally important is not just, you know, again, it's not just the amount of money, it's the velocity of the money and how often it's spent. So, you know, they could have done all that stimulus and we could have taken the money and stuck it under our mattresses and it wouldn't have had any effect. But it's the exact opposite. People are getting money and they're spending it. I think our consumer psychology has changed because of the pandemic, our behaviors, and that'll all normalize again at some point. But we're still, I think we've all underestimated how strong the consumer would be, even with real wages that are negative, even with higher interest rates, with 6-7% mortgages. We're just underestimating consumption, but that will change. It's just a question of when,
right?
When the rat gets through the python.
Yeah, and we could talk about this for the next several hours, I'm sure. You know, retail sales numbers haven't been stellar, so we know that spending is. You know, again, not like superpowering higher. And we've been looking at household balance sheets and seeing, you know, revolving debt go back to record levels and all that stuff. So we could be in this interim phase where people haven't changed their buying behavior much, but they're shifting how they're financing it, right? From the stimulus they were receiving to putting it on the credit card at this point in time. And that has some expiration date. We just don't know exactly when. Mm-hmm. But as you said, we're kind of in the dark trying to figure all this out.
And inflation skews the data drastically as well. It makes it really hard to decipher.
Right, because basically most of this is reported in dollar sales, right? Exactly. So, you know, if inflation's contributing to sticker, the amount on the sticker, we may have not as great sales, but it still looks better because we have the higher dollar per sale amount. All right, Mike Preston, I'm coming to you with a question here, which you can really answer it any way you like, but it's sort of a question on how to hedge precious metals positions. So Ratchet says, I have a long position in silver miners. Is it a good strategy to short silver to hedge for a shorter point of time as we are going through a pullback right now? I'll let you answer that any way you like, but basically if you've got a sizable precious metals position, what are some of the ways that you at New Harbor would hedge it?
Well, we do have a sizable precious metals miner position in our portfolio. We choose to hedge it with options. We're primarily in the liquid ETFs. GDX is our biggest position in that space, and it's relatively easy to hedge with options. When you get into intermarket hedging, like shorting one asset against another, you got to be careful with correlations. You've got to be careful with leverage. I'm not sure how the questioner is shorting silver, presumably maybe with a futures account, unless they're shorting one of the ETFs. I'd have to think it through and do some numbers, but you know, to my mind, silver is going to be a pretty imperfect hedge against silver miners. Silver is going to be a lot less volatile than the silver miners themselves. Speaking of the gold and silver market, we saw in the last couple of weeks gold come off about 5% from its high, silver maybe 10% from its high, and it was pretty quick. It was a pretty rapid correction as well, and it happened at the same time roughly that the dollar went from about 100 to 103. But gold was down 5 and silver was down 10, but the miners, particularly the silver miners, were down close to 20. So there's been a multiplicative effect on the miners, and unfortunately the miners have really underperformed so far the rally in gold and silver over the last year or so. Well, we've shared some charts on other videos that we've done, Adam. And it's our thesis that gold and silver miners will catch up to gold and silver, but they haven't yet, and they have been underperforming. As far as the gold charts go, we're back under 2000 at about 1975 on the futures price. But the longer-term gold chart looks very good and constructive. If you look at the monthly chart, it's held above 1820 for a whole bunch of months now. And this came after 7 straight down months last year. It was the longest string of down months since the 1980s, I think. And then we had nearly straight 6 straight or 7 straight up months. There was one down month in there, but it's been a vertical bounce from those levels. And here at 1975 or so, I think the gold chart still looks okay, down to about 1900, maybe 1920. If we go through there and retest that old critical point of 1820, well, certainly I'll be wrong, I guess. But to me right now, this just looks like a consolidation that looks constructive. Some people point out that the long-term gold chart looks like it could be a triple top. The miners chart looks like it could be a double top. That's true, but this market's been tricky. It's in my opinion, and maybe it's just because I'm bullish on the space, I think it's more likely a shakeout than a double top in miners or a triple top in gold. So we'll see. This market has been fooling everybody for a long time. It happened last year to the downside. Right now, there's this question mark about people that are positioning themselves to the upside. I would accumulate gold in here in the 1900s. I think it still looks bullish. Let's wait and see. But just to close, back to the hedging question, I would prefer to use options for that type of thing and not use intermarket spreads.
Okay. And obviously, if folks want to learn more about how to hedge with options, they can do two things. One, they can watch the free webinar that Mike, you and your partner, John, there put together. And I believe the URL for that is wealthion.com/optionshedging. I'll double check that, folks, though, and I'll put it in the live chat. But Jonathan Wellam, I want to give you a chance to chime in on this too, because I know that you are a close follower of the precious metals mining sector. We'd just love to sort of get your latest outlook given current conditions in the space.
Yes, I mean, we like the space simply as an offset. I mean, it provides a hedge and to some of the other areas in the marketplace. But we're concerned, as we've talked about here, the overall debt situation and fiat currency under pressure and increased inflation and so forth. So the way we play it, because we're not geologists and we're not studying all the mining companies, I mean, we do have a few mining companies in the gold space. We have Agnico Eagle would be one of our major sort of positions that we have in terms of miners, but we typically invest in a number of the royalties. So we have been long-term owners of Franco-Nevada, which would be on the more expensive side. And more recently, we've added to Osisko and have a little bit of Sandstorm also in terms of some of the royalties, which would have a much more larger exposure to gold. In terms of silver, we've been long-term investors also in Wheaton Precious Metals, which would be at this point about 50% silver, have a little bit of Silver Crest in terms of miners. We really try to stick to major players, great balance sheets, good cash flow coming in, often already paying dividends. We like the space. We think that silver has got great upside over the long term. It has been volatile the last month, which has been pointed out, dropped quite a bit. We think though that given the production and the demand for it over time, it's going to be a great place to be, and people just need dollar cost average, buy high quality and be invested in the space. And the same thing with gold. Again, we're long-term bulls on gold, and that's largely because we're very concerned about the monetary situation, the debt situation. And so again, the way we go in is through more of the royalty companies. So we build positions, I'd say about 15 to 18% of someone's portfolio would have exposure to these kinds of businesses in our client portfolios. And they've done well over time, despite the ups and downs in the gold and silver market, because the royalties are real cash flow generators. We've also recently just added another company, which we probably should have bought a number of years ago, but we like their exposure also. And that would be Altius Minerals, smaller company, about $1 billion market cap, Canadian. But has got great royalties in potash, also copper, nickel, a couple of the other sort of battery assets and commodities that we think will be important over time. But again, these are positions that we're taking for the next 3 to 5 years. We're not in trying to time the market, trying to buy companies that really know how to allocate capital in the space.
All right, great. And folks, if you're interested in learning more about how the royalty model works, go watch the interview that I did with Jonathan about a month ago, where he goes into this in really good depth. It's actually really fascinating to understand how that model works. I also did confirm that if you want to watch that free webinar on general use cases for options as hedging tools, it is wealthion.com/optionshedging. I put that link in the live chat there. And I forgot to say earlier too that, if you want to talk through strategies for how to use options or other ways to hedge really anything in your portfolio, you can talk to any one of these financial advisors by filling out the short form at wealthion.com. We'll talk more about that in just a moment. All right. So I want to go to a question here. I'll direct this to you, John Lodra. This is a question that I just think a lot of people are asking themselves in frustration. This is coming from Jeff, who I know from his participation on this channel is a younger guy. And he asked this question: will I ever be able to purchase a home? Cash buyer who's been priced out due to constant bidding wars here in St. Louis, Missouri. So again, to ask you one of the harder questions there, John, for the folks that are just pulling their hair out about how the extreme levels of unaffordability in the housing market, they've seen the cost of mortgages more than double over the past 2 years. And yet in many markets, maybe prices have cooled off, and the fact that they're not rising as much as they were, but they really haven't come down much. And so in a lot of ways, it's kind of the worst time to buy a house. You're getting the expensive price and the expensive financing. So what would you say to Jeff here?
Yeah, well, Jeff, it's not your imagination that it's difficult. The affordability of houses has never been more on affordable, broadly speaking. I can relate. I've got two young gentlemen sons, gentlemen sometimes anyways, and they're in the early parts of their professional careers. And so I know firsthand how, you know, their views on the matter. Look, we are working through a massive distortion of the financial markets and asset markets that have been engineered over the last decade by quantitative easing. This is going to take some time to work through. There are massive dislocations, especially with houses and all asset, really, prices get set at the margin. So in order for a seller to put their house on the market, they've got to be motivated to sell. And you know, many homeowners, for example, right now, even if they wanted to sell, they probably wouldn't, because they're sitting on maybe a mortgage rate that's, you know, many hundreds of basis points lower than what current mortgages are. So the thought of selling and then going and buying a new home and, you know, financing with a much higher mortgage is just trapping a lot of folks in homes. But these things have a way of working out on a more macro schedule, not the micro schedules that we humans want to live our lives. So I would just, you know, encourage you to be patient. One way or the other, this has got to resolve. I mean, over decades, workers' wages have not kept pace as a percent of GDP. Corporate profits have you know, basically taken the lion's share there. And one way or the other, hope it's a market solution and not a, you know, pitchforks in the street solution that arises here, or some governmental, you know, intervention that orchestrates a false solution here. But I think it's just a matter of time and patience for these dislocations and asset bubbles to work their way through the system. And of course, real estate is always a hyper local phenomena. There are some markets that are just still robustly strong, and others that are seeing some severe weakness. So really depends on where you are and where you can be, or where you can consider buying a home. But I feel for you. I've got, again, as I said, two young adult sons that, you know, certainly they would like to someday own a house or have a place they can call home and not just pay out rent to a landlord. So that's the best I can do here.
Okay. Well, we are approaching near the end of the hour here. You know, I've asked a lot of questions, amalgamations of questions that folks sent in advance of this live session that have been pulling, obviously, live questions here. Let me just sort of dial around here and let you guys mention anything else that we maybe haven't talked about yet, but that you think is germane to this current moment in the investing cycle that you think people should be keeping in mind. So I'm just going to dial around you literally counterclockwise. So Mike Leibowitz, let's start with you here. What would your parting counsel be to today's viewers?
I think just be very careful. There's a lot of different opinions on what's going to happen. And most of those people making the opinions have been wrong for the last few years, especially those at the Federal Reserve, a lot of people on Wall Street. So look, none of us know what is going to happen. This debt cap will be resolved, but there's the bigger issue in my, the much, much bigger issue in my mind is the lag effect of all the prior rate hikes and the Fed's wanting to keep rates higher for longer. And when does that affect everything? And it's very difficult because we're just continue to underestimate what happened with the pandemic fiscally and monetarily. So just pay close attention and the markets will do what they do. Liquidity will drive markets, but liquidity will take away from markets. And as I kind of started the year, I said, just be ready to be audible. You may be very bullish for a few weeks and then get back to bearish and hold cash and not hold cash. And it's just important to watch and learn.
Yeah, that whole year of the audible that we started out with, that prediction, it's really right. Proven true so far. Jonathan, let's head to you.
Yeah, I would echo the fact that be careful, be conservative. There's a lot of things going on and we don't know exactly how it's all going to pan out. And let's be humble about that. Our focus is on what we're investing in. So the companies, so we're looking for companies with great balance sheets, moats, protected businesses, pricing power, which has been very important. We've seen that companies with great pricing power can can again pass those price increases on to their consumers and maintain margins, high returns on invested capital, and businesses that are essential. And that's our focus. And again, we can shift quickly if things move quickly, but most of our investments we're trying to make are truly longer term investments and take advantage of the volatility. Don't be afraid of the volatility that can hit the market. It's always an opportunity to dollar cost average and buy things that come down a lot in value that you wish you could have owned. Just be patient and things generally will come back in line and give you lots of opportunities.
All right. Well said. Moving on to Mike Preston here real quick before I do, just want to ask the viewing audience here, if you guys continue to enjoy this live format and the monthly format of bringing all our advisors here together in one place to let you guys ask questions, please let us know in the live chat or if you're watching the replay in the comments section below. We're always listening to your feedback because obviously we want to continue to make programming that is tailored to exactly what you guys want to see. Okay, with that said, Mike Preston, your closing words.
Just keep it simple. 60-40 or just passive indexing has done great for the last 10 years plus. It's probably not going to produce positive returns going forward over the next decade from these nosebleed levels. You're going to have to be more tactical. So you've got a great alternative now. Hold a good chunk in short-term treasuries. Nibble on the long end of the curve with some longer-term high-quality U.S. bonds. Perhaps consider a position in mining companies. We do recommend that people have 5 to 10% of their investable assets in real assets like gold and silver, but a good chunk of what you've got, and as I mentioned earlier, close to half of what we're managing is in safe assets waiting to tactically deploy. So keep it simple.
All right, keep it simple. And somebody just reminded me in the chat, yes, please, if you've been enjoying this video, please do us a favor, support this channel by hitting the like button and then clicking on that red subscribe button below if you haven't already, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. I also want to let folks know too that, you know, if you want to have a discussion with any of the advisors that you've seen here in today's chat, just go to wealthion.com, that URL that's up on the screen right now, fill out the short form there, only takes you a couple of seconds, and then you can have a free consultation with the advisor of your choice. You can let the algorithm match you, or you can tell us specifically whom you want to talk to. Again, those consultations are totally free. There's no commitment to work with these guys. They just offer it as a public service to help people become better informed and hopefully take more prudent action today versus what might be coming tomorrow. John Lodra, you get the cleanup position here. Let's hear your parting words.
Yeah, well, I can't leave this without commenting about the AI hype that's going on. You know, certainly there's been some tremendous advancements in that technology, but you know, I'll direct folks. Fred Hickey, who you've had on your program, Adam, high tech strategist. He had a great tweet thread. You know, this is not new. AI has been around in some form or another for you know, a few decades now. You know, NVIDIA reports this week. Who knows? Maybe they beat and blow at earnings and stock rallies. But you know, I would remind folks there's plenty of areas of the market that are not quite as sizzly, not quite as hyped up right now. We're looking very close at old school industries like energy and industrials. You know, we use relative strength and other sector you know, kind of selection tools, and there are areas that we think are going to be more appetizing and timely than piling into the AI trade. Go out and find the letter. There was a letter floating around on Twitter sphere about it was the letter from the CEO of Sun Microsystems in 2002, basically saying, "What were you thinking, shareholders? We were trading for 10 times sales in 2000, and I would have to have, you know, given 100% of our revenue to you, the shareholders, not pay any salaries or whatever." That's the kind of bubble I think we're in, and certainly some stocks and some aspects of things like AI. So very, very, be very careful out there, just get back to sound fundamentals, I think.
All right, very well said. Well, I want to thank you all for your time today. I want to thank you all in advance too for your continued coming on this program week after week after week to help, you know, keep people grounded and keep people updated as to how your thinking and your portfolio allocation approach is evolving given, you know, all the developments on the ground that are happening in this very confusing year for investors. Folks, if you've enjoyed this, please thank our panel participants here in the chat there. But everybody, this was a great discussion and look forward to having you back on the channel next month to do this again. Thanks so much, everybody.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Good day, everybody.